Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Loopcast. I'm Chelsea Damon, and today we are going to talk about evolving terror, the development of jihadist operations targeting Western interests in Africa, and we have David Gartenstein-Ross back on the show after a bit of time. It's been a while since we've had you back on the show, David, so welcome to the Loopcast again.
Thank you, Chelsea. It's great to be back, and we were talking about this off-air just before we started recording, but congratulations on all the success that the Loopcast has achieved. It's really a tremendous resource. You and Sina have kept it going for a while and have been able to really have a number of great conversations with people doing interesting work, and I know that you have a really devoted audience out there, so I'm proud to have been a part of this when it started, and it's great to be back on with you now.
Oh, thank you so much. And it's true. You were one of our, what I call like the original set of guests, because you've been on the Loopcast for a number of years on and off. So we always thank you too, because you're part of making the Loopcast what it is. So thank you. And for our listeners, just in case you don't know of David's fantastic and very impressive background, I will give you a little info. So he is a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and the topic we're going to be talking about today is actually a paper from FDD, as the acronym goes. And he's also the chief executive officer, at Valence Global, which is a consulting firm that focuses on challenges that are posed by violent non-state actors. And he's also a fellow with Google's Jigsaw, which is a really interesting initiative. If you haven't checked that out, definitely go to their website. And he's also an associate fellow at the International Center for Counterterrorism, which is at The Hague, and an assistant professor at Georgetown University in their security studies program. So David's got this huge body of work and huge career that he's had. So it's always fantastic to have you on the show, David. So this great co-authored paper, and you've got three different authors that were on this with you. Really, really interesting findings. So why don't you tell me what caused all of you to actually write this paper in the first place?
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for that very glowing introduction. I'm still blushing a little bit.
You're welcome.
But it actually came out of a project we worked on initially for the Canadian government. The Canadian Department of National Defense has an academic outreach effort, and they have particular interest in Africa. It's actually the second year in a row where we've done a study for them looking at Africa, because Canada has a lot of various interests, commercial interests, and they keep flirting with whether or not they're going to help send peacekeepers over to the Malian mission, which of course is an increasingly perilous mission. So that's what initially prompted our interest. We were interested in continuing to work with our friends in Canada, and looking at what we thought would have the most value. We like doing things through a data-based approach. To me, the more data sets we have, the more value we're able to wring out of it. I'm undertaking a larger project, a book project, which is looking at the way jihadist groups learn. And so looking at the past decade of attacks in Africa, I thought would be interesting. And generally speaking, for me, when I work with data, the way I prefer to do it is more in line with how data scientists who work with big data use it. I only dabble in big data, but generally speaking, social science and big data are kind of opposite in terms of their approach to numbers. With social science, you start out with a hypothesis, and then you run a test to see if it validates your hypothesis. Whereas really when you're using big data, sometimes you'll have a hypothesis attached to it, or you'll start with hypotheses. But really what you're doing is picking up the data, shaking it around, and seeing what comes out when you look for patterns within it. So here, we didn't come in with an extraordinary amount of presumptions about what the data would show. I mean, there are a few things that one could know in areas where I was a little bit surprised when I looked at the numbers, but one could know, for example, that post-Arab Spring, there's been an explosion in jihadist activity, that it's higher. we found, in fact, that the rate of terrorism, jihadist terrorism, has basically tripled since the Arab Spring, which was a little bit more of a rise than I had expected. And to some extent, in fairness, somewhat unrelated to the Arab Spring, because Somalia is driving a lot of the numbers, and Somalia itself is not, the situation there is not a creation of the revolutions that we saw back in 2011. But anyway, that's a little bit about why we decided to do it and the reason that we approached it using this particular lens.
And on that info on the tripling of attacks, so you had some figures in the report, and you said from January 2007 to December 2011, jihadists conducted 132 successful, thwarted, or failed attacks against Western interests in Africa. And then going on this figure tripling, there are 358 attacks between January 2012 and October 2017, which, like you said, that's a huge increase in the amount of time that we're looking at here. So let's talk about why this is happening.
So as I said, part of it is linked to Somalia, which is a different story than the rest of Africa, but there's a reason why the numbers break as they do in Somalia, which is until 2012 approximately, Shabaab was the dominant military force in southern Somalia. It was essentially governing territory. And so it was fighting, like, one could describe it either as an insurgency or else as a de facto regular military. And so most of the attacks they were carrying out were not terrorist attacks. Terrorist attacks are a very specific thing. Not all attacks carried out by a group like Shabaab or even ISIS or Al-Qaeda are terrorist attacks. A lot of them instead fit the mode of insurgent warfare. Terrorist attacks are geared specifically at civilians for the purpose of terrorizing and attaining objectives that way. But when Shabaab was no longer the dominant force in southern Somalia, it resorted to using much more in the way of terrorist attacks. So that's one of the reasons for the increase there. Then if we look to North Africa and the Sahel region, that's where you do get into the Arab Spring effect. In particular, the degeneration of Libya, which has been much more of a driver than events in Tunisia, although in Egypt we also have seen a significant increase in terrorism since the revolution there. But Libya has been a major driver. The country was never put back together. And one could trace fairly clearly the connection between events in Libya and not just attacks in the country of Libya, which have increased significantly against target types that we mentioned, but also the way in which it had a causal impact on northern Mali in driving terrorism in Tunisia, where some of the major attacks that we saw in 2015, like an attack that we saw against tourists in the beach in Sousse and an attack that we saw at the Bardo Museum in Tunis, were devised in the city of Sabratha in Libya. So there's a very direct connection there, which all of which provides some of the why. There's one other thing I'd point to on the why end, which is that these groups, jihadist groups, are demonstrating a very clear learning curve. They've been moving towards tactics that are more effective at striking the kind of targets that they're going after, especially targets that are fairly heavily fortified, things like hotels, government compounds. They've moved from simpler attacks, things like a car bomb or a set of attackers with guns, to multi-phased attacks. For example, one thing that we've seen used a lot in Somalia is a car bomb used to soften a target, the perimeter fence, followed by a team of attackers coming in on foot. And lately, there have been a number of instances where those attackers on foot are wearing Somali security services uniforms, like the Somali army uniforms, even having ID cards. So when they show up, they look like a rescue force. They don't look like attackers. After that, they've been able to do some other things that show adaptation. Seizing hostages in the hotel and using the hotel's defenses as their defenses. So the learning curve, and we've seen this across most of the sectors we've looked at, with the exception of hostage taking and oil and gas, energy, mineral resources. Across the other categories, we've seen a learning curve in all of them, which is another reason why we're seeing an increase in the attacks and also an increase in the results that they're attaining.
And I think that's one of the really interesting parts of this report. And as you said, you're talking about doing a book on this, and it's this idea of groups learning and developing and changing their tactics and learning from each other. So, I mean, that's going to be a fascinating topic, and I look forward to a book on that because I'm very interested in that topic. But going to the target types, you mentioned five different target types, and I was wondering if we could talk about those a bit. I can either list them and you can elaborate on that, or you can tell us about the five targets, however you'd like to go about it.
Sure. Either way works. I might as well just tell about what the targets are and what we found. So as the name of the study suggests, it's focused on attacks against Western interests. And, you know, people have asked me why for that, but part of it is just you have to figure out a frame of some kind. And you know, as a Westerner, something which is of concern for me. The five target types we've looked at are establishments that are popular among foreigners, you know, restaurants and hotels among them. Secondly, energy and mineral resources, their infrastructure and their facilities. Third is non-African tourists, expatriates, and NGO workers. Fourth is national and international government facilities, such as embassies and UN humanitarian compound. And fifth is the aviation industry. And within that, we found that, you know, I mentioned energy and mineral resources as being a target where we haven't seen a great deal of innovation. That's an area where most of the attacks have been attacks against pipelines, which have a disruptive effect, but usually actually don't even result in the loss of life. There have been a couple of attacks against, you know, major gas facilities, one of them being the notorious In Amenas attack in Algeria, where right after the French intervention in Mali, you had Mokhtar Belmokhtar's organization go in, seize a large number of hostages, and even try to destroy the In Amenas facility. But there we saw, you know, a spike in attacks back in 2011 that has receded since, and we haven't seen a great deal of innovation in that regard. Across the others, we've seen either innovation or change. So for establishments popular among foreigners, such as restaurants and hotels, there's been that move, which I described, towards more multi-phased attacks. And in Somalia in particular, one thing that we've seen in Mogadishu is, you know, just a relentless pace of attacks, where sometimes there even will have been warnings or you know, similar attacks in the area. But still, that car bomb to soften it up, followed by, you know, attackers rushing in on foot, it keeps on succeeding in taking a lot of lives, sadly. In attacks against tourists, expatriates, and NGO workers, we've seen, and it was very clear when we actually kind of mapped out the difference between the two periods examined, the 2007 to 2011 versus 2012 onward, one could see a migration of these attacks southward, especially in kidnappings / hostage taking. It's something that Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb now uses as a major source of revenue. They even, according to open source reports, provide bounties for criminal groups who are able to bring them non-American Westerners, non-American because the Americans don't actually pay ransoms. For national international government facilities, we've seen very much the same progression that we've seen for hotels and other establishments popular among foreigners, where there's been that move to multi-phased attacks. And you know, within them, I mentioned Somalia, but we've also seen them in other areas. Al-Qaeda Islamic Maghreb and Mokhtar Belmokhtar have been carrying out hotel attacks in West Africa, and a lot of the attacks on government facilities have come in Libya, where Western embassies were targeted. In fact, in Libya, we saw a drop over the past couple of years, not because it's gotten less dangerous, but rather because the danger level reached the point where a lot of Western governments just pulled their personnel out of Libya. Right now, for example, The U.S. does not have diplomatic staff in Libya. Their diplomatic staff is next door in Tunisia. Finally, there's the aviation industry, where, like a few of the other categories, Somalia has been a major driver. But we've seen an increase in sophistication, a move from basically projectiles being launched with indirect fire against airports to now more complex attacks against airports, but also very serious attacks against aviation. It's not as well known as it could be, but there was an attack on a Dalo Airlines flight a few years ago in which the suicide bomber managed to get on board the plane with a laptop with a bomb on it. Fortunately, it took off. The laptop bomb blew off during the takeoff phase. They hadn't yet hit altitude, and so they were able to crash land it. The bomber actually blew himself out of the plane, but the plane was otherwise able to land with people unmolested. But to me, the big significance there, as is often the case for aviation, is the fact that they got the bomb on board the plane. They're very much like another major aviation attack we saw in Africa, that being the Metrojet attack out of Sinai that was carried out by ISIS. You had, seemingly in both cases, an insider threat element. And then subsequently, after the Dalo Airlines flight, you've seen other attempts in Somalia, specifically in the Beledweyne Airport a couple of years ago, in March of 2016. You had a laptop bomb explode in the airport, and in the same incident, authorities found and defused two more bombs. One of those bombs was hidden in a printer, which, for those who follow these things, automatically you'll understand that is reminiscent of a design that was developed by Ibrahim al-Assiri, who's an al-Qaeda the Arabian Peninsula member and one of the most innovative jihadist bomb makers. Moreover, given the proximity of Somalia to Yemen, both al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and Shabab are organizations, and those are the Somalia and Yemen-based branches of al-Qaeda. They're organizations that one would expect to share tactics, techniques, and procedures, and that particular aviation incident is suggestive of sharing between them. This is something that in briefings I've given on the study and other conversations I've flagged as a concern. I think that there will definitely be more attempts on aviation in the not-too-distant future.
And so touching on that point of innovation and learning, this idea and actually what is taking place is these outside jihadists, say outside of Africa, since we're talking about the region of Africa, they're teaching the jihadist groups and jihadists in Africa new techniques and innovations. So let's discuss that a bit, because that's a big factor in where groups are going to go and potential tactics that they'll develop. So let's talk about that. It's very important.
Yeah. So one thing I'm interested in there, like I think with the example I gave, we clearly see learning going in one direction from al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula to Shabab. It strikes me that there maybe instances in the future where learning goes in the other direction. And that may already be happening, by the way. It's just a little bit, it's harder to map in a study like this, especially since it was very much focused on what's happening in Africa and not outside. But, most of the major studies on learning, especially some of the recent scholarship on terrorist learning, bears out that learning is often bidirectional as opposed to simply unidirectional. So, in other words, generally speaking, you're not just going to have a jihadist group come in and teach some of their brethren about how to do cool things with bombs on airplanes and not learn something from it. One thing that strikes me is that given the comparative lack of attention that outside states are paying to the continent, it could end up serving essentially as an innovation laboratory where some of these outside groups concentrate resources to try to hone techniques in Africa before exporting them elsewhere. We have, of course, seen African jihadists show up in a lot of other places, including in Syria. You had a large Tunisian contingent. There are more Tunisians who went to join ISIS in Syria than any other nationality. So there's here we what we can see, clearly see when looking at Africa is the flow of learning into Africa. If we're to broaden the aperture and look at other regions, I think that one thing what one would see is both the flow of learning out in this regard, and also groups that where any assistance they provide is geared towards learning something in the process of providing that assistance to African jihadist groups.
And we were talking about the aviation attacks. It was interesting to see you have graphs within the report, and they're very good and clear, and it shows you the groups that are doing some of the different attacks or the different tactics they're using. And I remember reading that Al-Shabaab, of course, was like the number one in the aviation attacks. And then it was Ansar al-Sharia, Libya, and third was ISIS. And then there are smaller groups that are doing things. But as you said, Al-Shabaab is the, of course, main group that we're seeing a lot of these attacks happening or attempted attacks. So I was wondering if we could discuss that a little bit, the different groups in the region and their rank and file, I guess you could say.
Sure. Within the context of aviation, and I'll go a little bit broader than aviation, but Shabaab is a Somali-based militant group. It's an offshoot of another group called the Islamic Courts Union. Somalia has been, without a government able to control the entirety of the country since the early 1990s, since the collapse of the Siad Barre regime. Now, when we look at aviation attacks, to be clear, a lot of the aviation attacks are similar to what I mentioned before, like indirect fire against airports, where mortars are being shot at airports. So it's, you know, it's an attack on aviation, quite literally. But it's also not an attack on aviation where there's a big risk of a flight being brought down. Now, the two big exceptions were the aforementioned Dalo Airlines flight, where the bomber got on board the plane and then flew himself out of the plane, and ISIS's attack in the Sinai Peninsula, and then one other attack, the Beledweyne attack, where there was a printer bomb. For Ansar al-Sharia in Libya, which is a Libya-based jihadist organization, which now seems to be largely defunct and kind of used, basically having been bled into other groups in Libya. But that group mounted kind of similar attacks on airports without an attempt to bring down a plane. So within, when you look at the African jihadist context, there's always this debate, which is, I'd say, a little bit artificial between kind of the local versus the transnational. The reason I talk about I say it's a little bit artificial is because both can coexist, and I think that to some extent people engage in a debate about which one's more important or talking past each other. But if you look at the groups organizationally, Africa tends to have a lot of groups that are tied to to Al-Qaeda, either expressly or having some sort of covert relationship. Al-Shabaab joined Al-Qaeda formally in early 2012, but one can see from the letters recovered from bin Laden's compound in Abbottabad that they were actually a part of the organization prior to that, and bin Laden, before his death, wouldn't let them announce that they were part of Al-Qaeda. Similarly, for Ansar al-Sharia Tunisia, several years ago, I had a debate on the Loopcast, in fact, about whether they were, how close they were to Al-Qaeda. And it's become clear since then that in fact, they had taken the leader of that group, which, again, like Ansar al-Sharia Libya, it's now kind of largely defunct. It was the political wing of what Al-Qaeda was trying to do in Tunisia, with the military wing being Qatibat Uqba ibn Nafi. And now that the organization is outlawed and pursued, the old Ansar al-Sharia, to the extent that they're still with the organization, has basically, best I can tell, joined Qatibat Uqba ibn Nafi. But at any rate, one can see that there were bayat. There was a pledge of bayat from the leader of Ansar al-Sharia, from Abu Iyad al-Tanizi, to the head of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, to Abdul Malik Drukdel. Then there's Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, which also is, you know, a major player. Katibat Uqba ibn Nafi, which I mentioned, now describes himself as being a battalion of al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. But like a lot of places, ISIS has also made inroads. Boko Haram joined ISIS back in 2015. ISIS had a strong presence in Libya for some time. It controlled Sirte, and its fighters who left Sirte, because not all of them were killed when Sirte was taken back from ISIS, have dispersed. I think there's still a question about where most of them will end up. Then there's the Malian conflict, where you have a number of different jihadist organizations. Some of the most powerful ones are tied to al-Qaeda. I think there are some groups which can be accurately described as independent as part of that conflict. And you also have ISIS groups emerging in Mali as well, though as best I can tell, based on open source information, they seem to be a little louder than they are strong. Those are the basic conflict areas. So when you break it down by country, the various countries have different threat levels, with the ones where there's the most open conflict being Somalia, Mali, and Libya.
And so just to play the devil's advocate for people that might not know a lot about terrorism or issues in Africa, why are we seeing these groups in Africa, and why are they targeting Western interests?
The answer there, actually, I think will differ substantially from one country to another. When you look at driving factors, in some cases we don't, the answers are less scientific than we'd want. And one could draw together multiple things. And, in Somalia, you had a government that collapsed, essentially, almost 30 years ago. There is a rise of Islamist groups there, which in part relates back to some of the early proselytization from Wahhabi organizations. But whenever there's 30 years of anarchy in a country, 30 years of a government that can't extend a writ throughout the country, it's going to have an impact in terms of militant groups of some stripe coming to the fore. In Tunisia, one of the things people have looked at heavily is youth unemployment, where I think there is a connection. There's others as well in terms of the strategy of Dawa that got opened up post-Arab Spring. There were less powerful but still present militant groups there prior to 2011. In Libya, you had a governmental collapse, which in turn helped to influence the collapse of the government in northern Mali. You also have an issue in northern Mali with Tuareg groups and their grievances towards the government. To be very clear, the Tuareg groups, by and large, are not jihadist groups. You have some Tuareg jihadist groups, but jihadists were able to exploit that situation, and there's some lessons to be learned there. So the point being, and that's really a 10,000-foot look at it, but the point is, from one country to another, you have some very different dynamics. You'll often have a number of different factors that basically coalesce together to produce the situation that they do vis-a-vis militancy. And similarly, the attacks on Western targets will have different rationales. In Somalia, attacking Western targets is, among other things, a means to getting supporters of the UN-recognized government out of the country so that Shabaab can, again, play a dominant role in southern Somalia. Over in Tunisia, I think there's actually a very clear strategy, and I wrote on this in the CTC Sentinel a few years ago, which is that Tunisia, while it's, I think, rightly regarded as an Arab Spring success story, it's also a very fragile country. You have a large amount of the Tunisian economy dependent upon tourism, and tourist targets, as a result, are a way where a militant group can kill Westerners and also significantly diminish the Tunisian economy. in 2015, when you had a couple of horrifying attacks against tourism, and I mentioned this before, one at the Bardot Museum, and then the Seuss Beach attack, where you had an attacker who, you know, the attacker's name was Saifedean Rezgui. He was able to go onto the beach disguised as a tourist. He hid an assault rifle in his umbrella, and was able to shoot, you know, just go across the beach shooting tourists primarily for about 30 minutes before he was finally stopped by Tunisian police. And after that, we saw a clear economic impact. You know, the tourism sector accounts for about 15% of Tunisia's GDP. It contributes to about 14% of the country's employment. And Tunisia's tourism revenue after the Seuss attack fell 35% the following year. So if you look at it strategically from the perspective of jihadist organizations, it's an ability to, they have the ability to carry out attacks. You know, if you attack this sector, the tourism sector, this weak underbelly, it could have create what I call a vicious cycle, where it in turn, you know, the attack in turn reduces employment, harms the economy, and then jihadist groups can use that dynamic to recruit. So there'll be different reasons, and when one looks at the strategic purpose, and the commercial strategic purpose is, you know, one can see it in a lot of places. One can see it in the Ivory Coast attack also against tourist targets. But when one looks at the specifics of the attack and the dynamics of the country, you don't have one constant reason, but instead they differ a bit from one theater to another, one country to another.
And something you were talking about earlier, this working of jihadist groups in Africa with criminal networks, I was wondering if you could discuss that a bit, because I find this nexus between terrorism and criminal groups or even organized crime very, very interesting, and we're seeing it more and more in lots of cases around the globe, actually.
Yeah, that's correct. And, you know, in our report, we're barely scratching the surface of what the nexus looks like. You know, since in the report, what we essentially were doing was measuring out specific kinds of attacks. We look at it through the lens of one attack category, that being the attack category of tourists, expatriates, and NGO workers. But in some of these attacks and kidnappings, but particularly the kidnappings are the key one here in terms of the nexus. In some of the kidnappings, you have groups like Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb or others capture the tourists or the foreigners in the first place and hold them for ransom, or else in some cases kill them. But in others, it seems that criminal gangs end up handing hostages over to jihadists. So in Niger, in October of 2016, an American aid worker named Jeffrey Woodkey was kidnapped from his home, which was in Abalak. And the Nigerian authorities believed that he was kidnapped by a criminal gang, and then the gang in turn handed him over to jihadists. I mentioned, you know, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb before, and their increasing financial reliance on kidnapping for ransom. There are reports, and I find them, you know, credible, that Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb has offered to pay up to $100,000 for captured non-American Westerners, hoping that they'd receive even more money in ransom payments. You know, AKIM has gotten, according to the former U.S. Undersecretary of the Treasury, David Cohen, they've gotten tens of millions of dollars through kidnapping for ransom. So an arrangement like that with criminal organizations, you know, makes sense from both perspectives. On the one hand, a lot of what jihadists do naturally blends into both the black and gray markets. And on the other hand, for criminal organizations, even if they don't necessarily like groups like AKIM, it presents them, you know, a money-making scheme that, you know, is, you know, as good as a lot of the other things that they engage in.
So thinking about all of the different types of attacks and the increase in attacks since, say, 2007 to 2017, when you look at the differences, that tripling from the 2007 to 2011, and then between 2012 and 2017, attacks tripled. What does this mean in the greater picture for the region and its security and stability?
Well, obviously, it's trending in the wrong direction. I think, you know, generally speaking, when you look at when you're trying to game things out in the longer term, one of the areas where people make mistakes is projecting out straight lines, because you always have feedbacks of some kind, either positive feedbacks which accelerate dynamics or negative feedbacks which slow them down that come into play. Unfortunately, if I were projecting things out, and again, you know, I haven't sat down and done this rigorously, at least for the short term, I think that we have, you know, kind of a lot of negative dynamics, ranging from, you know, a lot of governments that are very corrupt have trouble with governance. You have, you know, the tremendous impact of climate change being felt in Africa, which in turn creates, in particular, water scarcity is most acutely. I think everyone's been paying attention to the situation in South Africa, where one of the major cities faces a 0 day where the water will be turned off. You know, and that when you have a chaotic situation like that, that creates a dynamic where militant groups can find a way to benefit. That's one reason why when the Arab Spring hit, and it's been, you know, now almost a decade, you know, 3 years from now it'll have been a decade since the Arab Spring. So people remember this less and less over the years, but there's this tremendous triumphalism. You know, within my field, you know, most analysts were signing off on the idea that these revolutions were devastating to jihadist groups, that it undermined their narrative, that jihadist groups were standing by the sidelines and watching history fly by. And, you know, one reason I never really bought into that was because it would have been the first time, ever, that you've had major instability rack a region and militant groups couldn't figure out a way to find a place based on the chaos. Right now, the trend line is towards more chaos. At some point, that trend line, I hope, will change. It may be based on technological changes. It may be based on breakthrough in terms of water policy. It may be based on, you know, a state breaking down, but then kind of rebuilding in a way that makes more sense, where governance is a little bit more local and more manageable. But right now you have a lot of negative trend lines in Mali, in Libya, in Nigeria, in Somalia, that intersect with each other and make jihadism seem like it'll be, in the near term, a growing rather than receding problem.
And that's a very dim outlook, dim and dismal outlook. It's yes, but on a different note, what would you like our listeners to take away from this report? And we'll definitely post a link to it so people can read it in full if they're very interested in this topic. But what kind of takeaways would you like people to have from this?
Great. And I appreciate you doing so. I appreciate you posting the report, and I hope some of your listeners will be interested and will check it out. The main underlying one, I think, is I'll return to where we began, which is the more I look at jihadist organizations and look at why we have trouble both understanding and, you know, successfully countering them, it comes back to this central question of what are those organizations, how do they learn, how do they get better at what they do? You know, fundamentally, some jihadist organizations are incompetent. You know, some of them are not good at what they do. Some of them make a lot of errors. But oftentimes, when we look at a group and we see a number of failed attempts, those failures, if they cause us to write the group off, we sometimes don't actually understand what's happening, because sometimes the early failures are actually, you know, attempts at getting something right, where then they're learning and they're carefully calibrating lessons learned. To me, understanding terrorist organizations and militant organizations' learning processes is one of the most important things that we can do, because it's only by understanding those processes that we'll actually be able to effectively counter these scurrilous organizations.
And one last thing I want to ask you is, you mentioned that you are thinking about, or maybe you are already working on, a book on how terrorists learn and innovations and et cetera. So what's the timeline for that potentially?
Well, hopefully end of the year or early next year, I'll have it completely wrapped up. You listed all the stuff I'm working on at the outset, and some of those are actually a little bit dated. I'm not teaching at Georgetown or a fellow at Google anymore, though I still do some projects for Google. Regardless of that, and you can appreciate this as well, Chelsea, being in a PhD program, you were explaining to me off air just how much stuff you have going on. I've found that this has been one of the projects that is where I've kind of most found periods of it being stalled. I tend to like to just go through projects very quickly. But hopefully around the end of this year, I'll be wrapped up with the project. I feel like, I have a good co-author on it, and we're starting to kind of hit our strides. Within the next, say, 2 months, I'm planning to get the book proposal into an academic press. And hopefully we'll have more news on that front. But at the very least, we now have a production schedule and are, I think, starting to get the project on track. I've written a few before, but never before has my attention been spread about. It's a challenge.
It is. And like you said, you've got so much going on as well that you have to balance writing the book and all the extra sending out, like you said, proposals and so forth. So it's definitely a balance, but it sounds like a very exciting project. I look forward to hearing more about that, and good luck. And I just want to thank you once again for being on the Loopcast. It's always a pleasure.
And it's always a pleasure to join you. Again, congratulations on everything that the Loopcast has accomplished. And thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thank you.